This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
A special with Dr. Cornel West on poverty in America.
Cornel West is one of America's most gifted and, I think, provocative and important democratic intellectuals, now focusing much of his energy on his second national tour to heighten awareness of the growing, deepening, crushing poverty in the U.S. and aggressively committing to stopping stop and frisk practices and resisting efforts to privatize public education and against school closings.
The national discourse has been focused on the deterioration of the middle class, but this framework ignores the plight of the growing number of working poor and those not included in the workforce suffering crushing poverty. Organized labor's wages and benefits are under threat. Chronic high unemployment persists, increasing numbers of workers are falling off the unemployment rolls, and those new jobs created increasingly paying poverty wages. The recent census shows that more than 46 million Americans last year were living below the poverty line, which is $22,314 for a family of four, the highest level since 1993.
However, the rise of poverty has been ignored. It's been ignored by politicians and the mainstream media. But author, lecturer, public intellectual Cornel West is a welcome exception to that reality. He has co-authored the new book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto, and has been traveling the country broadsiding his message that now is the time to confront the underlying conditions of systemic poverty in America.
He's broadcasting the message that there are nearly 150 million impoverished people in America who aren't responsible for the Great Recession, yet they pay the price for it. The poor did not create the deindustrialization of America, unmitigated corporate profiteering and greed, more than a decade of foreign wars, and unregulated tax benefits for the wealthy. Rather, the housing and jobs crisis the plutocrats created have fostered a poverty unseen in generations, crossing race, age, and gender line.
Cornel West places the eradication of poverty, if we want any war, it's only one, the war on poverty, in the context of the nation's greatest movements of social transformation. The abolition of slavery, women's suffrage, and the labor and civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, as did Martin Luther King Jr., Dr. West raises ending poverty as the defining civil rights struggle of America's 21st century. Building on the legacy of Dr. King, Cornel asks, he asks us to re-examine our assumption about poverty in America, confront our dormancy, and travel the road laid out to undertake to eradicate poverty, to redistribute the wealth, and challenge the system that thrives off inequality. So we are now going to turn our attention to the first of a number of discourses on poverty, America, and struggle. Dr. Cornel West.
I was blessed to go to 18 cities and 11 states in 7 days with Brother Tavis on the poverty tour. And we were able to see the middle class brothers and sisters of all colors, all cultures, all civilizations and sexual orientations, because they're also immigrants with our brown brothers and sisters. They were black, they were brown, they were white. We started on the Indian reservation because it's always fascinating to look at America through the lens of the original peoples. It's a very important starting point. The original people. And we began with the notion that poor people are priceless and precious. Just as each individual has a dignity that ought to be affirmed. And what did we see, Brother Tavis? We saw the results of a system in place that has been driven by corporate greed at the top, with oligarchs ruling and politicians rotating, with money coming from the big banks, big corporations, pushing working people to the margins and rendering poor people superfluous, which is to say either unnecessary or, in the great metaphor of Ralph Ellison, invisible. So anytime you talk about poor people, you got to talk about the larger systemic context. How could it be that the top 400 individuals have wealth equivalent to the bottom 150 million fellow citizen? There's something sick about that. And they say, oh, they deserve that they're so smart. No, I know some smart folk broke as the Ten Commandments financially. They just can't get a job. They just can't get a job. If 1% of the population owns 41% of the wealth, and yet, what is it now, 56% of our precious children of all colors live in or near poverty, the kind of thing Marion Wright Ellison's been talking about? Mm-hmm. Something is deeply wrong. It's morally obscene. Then how could it be that poverty hasn't become the major moral and spiritual issue of our time? Because our leaders lack courage and independence. They're too tied to big money. How could it be that the prison industrial complex has been expanding and $300 billion has gone into jails and prisons and the criminal justice system, and yet when it comes to money for schools, money for housing, money for jobs with a living wage, it's a warped system. We're here because Martin Luther King Jr. and others said America is a sick society. America doesn't always have to be sick if Americans rise up the way the Occupy movement has been talking about and begin to talk about these issues seriously. And that's why this issue of poverty, as it affects the middle class, is now declining. Because if it was just a matter of black, brown, and red, we'd be voices in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. Because as long as there's a black face or a brown face on poverty, we overlook it. As long as there's a brown face, we overlook it. White middle class face, oh, we got a problem now. We're going to have to deal with some things. And that's fine, because we believe that white brothers and sisters have the same value as red and brown and black and yellow. And this moment, that's why I'm so excited about the manifesto that we wrote, brother. And we had a good time writing that thing. Oh, we did. We did. Recognizing the condition of poor people in America is a matter of national security, like Iraq, like Afghanistan, like whatever foreign policy that we know. And part of the problem in America is we don't have elected leaders who understand the tears. That it's not the external threat, it's the internal rot that's going to lead toward a collapse of American democracy into an oligarchy, a plutocracy, where the well-to-do live in gated spaces and working people and poor people are at each other's throats, and America goes under as we know it. That's important, and I feel that. And one of the reasons why we don't have the leadership among the 536 is that they are leading. They're just not leading in such a way that they make poor and working people a priority. When investment bankers are in trouble, they lead. They solve that problem. Here's big trillions of dollars. When the banking system's in problem, they lead. Action right away. When you need to go to war, action right away. How are you going to pay for it? We'll deal with it down the line. Oh, you're not going to pay for it, huh? No. That certain kind of leadership is called myopic, short-sighted, narrow. And in the end, it leads toward catastrophe. What we need is courageous, progressive, prophetic leadership. And the truth is this, that historically in America, it's been primarily the black prophetic tradition that provided that leadership, precisely because you had a people's enslaved, Jim Crowed on intimate terms with terror, trauma, and stigma, but still taught the country how to love. Taught the country how to love.
Justice is what love looks like in public. It has been the Frederick Douglasses and the Martin Kings and the Fannie Lou Hamers and the Ida B. Wells and the Dorothy Irene Height who taught us about justice, who taught us about love. And right now, the black prophetic tradition is very weak and feeble. Now, the black prophetic tradition has been the leaven in the American Democratic loaf. And you don't have to be black to be part of that tradition. You have to be connected with that tradition and choose to be a part of it. Miles Horton chose, John Brown chose, Barbara Ehrenreich chooses. It's not a matter of stereotype. You're part of a tradition that has taught America the best about itself, of how to love others even when you're hated, to talk about justice even when revenge is coming at you. That is spiritual. That is moral. It's not just a political question. And we got 536 leaders in Washington that are so obsessed with power, 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 money, 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 how they gonna get the lobbyists satisfied, where they gonna get money for the next re-election, that when it comes to moral and spiritual issues like the condition of our precious children of all colors, it's an afterthought. They talk about it during the election. And then as soon as they're elected, they back to business as usual. And we're going to go under. Even when we voted in 2008, even when we knew that the mean-spirited Republicans had pushed us to the brink of catastrophe, driven very much by corporate greed, we also knew that the system itself was broken. And just like when the black mayors took over cities that were in the process of breaking down, you get a black president in the White House in the process of a national system that is breaking down. And so we've got to keep our focus on the system, and we got to keep our focus on bodies, mind, hearts, and souls who have courage, vision, come together, organize, mobilize, because in the end, and this is where the legacy of Martin King becomes indispensable, that in the end, it's not about one person or one president. It is about a fundamental transformation. We need a transfer of power from unaccountable oligarchs and plutocrats to those Sly Stone call everyday people. That's what we're talking about. And that means every color, every religion, every non-religion. We're talking about, are you concerned enough about the future that you're willing to take a risk, pay a cost, live, and maybe die? And that is the challenge, you see, because I'll tell you my first prayer when I think of Brother Barack Obama. You know what my first prayer is? I pray for the safety of his family, his precious two little ones, and wife. How come? Because white supremacy on the right wing of side is real. It's very real. And those of us who have lived under those kind of threats for 30 years know exactly what we're talking about. How come they did? Because they love so much. They're willing to sacrifice. That's why Martin is gone. And most people don't want to die. They'd rather sell out than die. They'd rather sell out than die. But what we're talking about is not just one individual. We're talking about what kind of people we are. And if we don't have enough ordinary citizens of all colors to fight for your democracy here, just like you fight for it in Afghanistan under leadership formulations, then we're going to lose the democracy and poor people will still be caught. That's the challenge, it seems to me. That's a major challenge. That's the third moment in American history. Our first moment was against the British monarchy. People were willing to fight and they pushed out the imperialists. And the second was against slavery. They were willing to fight. They pushed out slavery. And Jim Crow was just another form of slavery, just like the new Jim Crow, a prison industrial complex, is just another form of slavery. And now the challenge in America is oligarchy. That's the challenge. And we have to have leadership that says, we love oligarchs, we hate oligarchy. Because oligarchs are human beings who make choices and they can change their minds. That's true. Just like white folk could choose to be white supremacists or they could fight white supremacy. You have to make a choice.
Let's look at the present election. Democracy almost gone anyway. Yeah.
Big money's in the driver's seat. All you need to do is look at the super PACs. All you need to do is look at the Supreme Court that is complicitous to the corporate money flowing in. It's almost gone already. ready. We've got to reinvigorate it. We've got to somehow renew it in that sense. But it's not hyperbolic in this sense, and I do agree with this.
I think the black prophetic tradition is very important. You see, I do believe in the Sankofa bird, which means you can't really move forward until you look back. And what you look back at are the great, courageous, loving, sacrificial people who shaped you, like your mother and father, my mother and father, and grandparents. And it goes on and on and on. And what the black prophetic tradition has taught America, that has been so obsessed with the future and the present, is that if you don't have a sense of history, and if you don't put yourself in a narrative that is rooted in something deeper than just money and fame and quick success and instant gratification, then the very capitalism that we're talking about has produced such hollow and shallow people that they're never gonna straighten their backs up and take a stand against anything because they're up for sale. That's what the system's all about. So that in that sense, history still becomes very important. The weakest, the most vulnerable, and we know how precious they are more likely to be in the worst social condition. What kind of people are we really when we examine ourselves and acknowledge that reality? That's not just sad. That's pathological. It really is. It really is. Oh, that's anti-American. No, I'm anti-injustice in America. That's not the same thing. I'm anti-injustice anywhere, but in America too. And that's unjust. But then the question becomes, if we're really serious about being poverty abolitionists, in calling for the eradication and abolition of poverty, we've got to target the young people, especially from birth to 5 years old. All the evidence talks about the shaping of their minds and hearts and souls, you see. And it's not just a matter of programs, it's also a matter of in civic societies. What kind of discourse, does this kind of discourse take place in churches, mosques, synagogues, civic institutions? No. Of the priorities at work. What's going on? The renaissance of compassion and the nonviolent democratic revolution that we're calling for against oligarchy has to take place across the board in every sphere of our society. That's part of the consciousness raising that needs to take place. You know, we moved from a stage of monopoly industrial capitalism to monopoly finance capitalism, so that 40 years ago, the banks only had 9 or 10% of the corporate profits in the whole economy. Today they have 43% of the corporate profits. And when you have banks that are not primarily interested in lending anymore, but rather trading on casino-like operations in which they make big money, but they don't produce any product. They're making billions of dollars. When the General Motors were making big money, they were producing product and they were providing jobs. Nowadays, it's speculative. That's what finance capitalism is globally. And we have to be honest about that and then say we've got to be practical in terms of how we're going to be able to preserve our dignity, integrity, organizing, mobilizing programs that help people. But you have to also tell people the very, very painful truth of the kind of system that we are living in. And unfortunately, it's very rare that they even get a chance to hear these kinds of truths about the kind of capitalism. People debating about Bain. Bain is the peak of an iceberg. Predatory capitalism has been at work for the last 30 years across the board in significant ways. Bain is not some isolated unit tied to private equity. This thing has been happening across the board. That's why trade unions pushed against their backs pushed against the wall. And so in that sense, it does look rather bleak at times, but this is another reason why the black prophetic tradition is important. If you've been under slavery for 244 years, it looks kind of bleak. But here comes Harriet Tubman anyway. Here come the spirituals anyway. If you've been Jim Crow for over 100 years in the land of liberty, it looks bleak. But here come the blues and John Coltrane and Sarah Vaughan and Martin King and A. Philip Randolph to say, you know what? We're going to teach you how to love and struggle for justice with your head high in the midst of darkness. That's what we're talking about. And that's how difficult it is. Under slavery, it was a crime for black people to love. You love your child, but they're selling your child Virginia and you in Georgia. You go crazy, or you get some spiritual fortitude. It was also a crime to hope.
We couldn't worship God without white supervision, so you stole away at night in the creek and you held hands in a ring shout and you raised your voices, you lift your voices and sang a spiritual. That was a crime in the land of religious liberty. So that no matter how dark it is, even in the present, it's hard to meet, to conceive of what my great-great-great-grandmother and great-great-great-grandfather had to wrestle with in the abyss of American slavery. I can't conceive of it even being worse, as bad as it is, but with this proviso, and this is where I want to say zero on young folk, because I spend a lot of time with young people. I learn a lot from young people. I see the Cornell West Theory right here, one of the grand hip-hop group here in Washington, D.C., around the country. And they're kind enough to mention them, name it after me and get in trouble, but I appreciate that. But I say this about young folk in a critical way, that I do not know of a wave of young people who are commensurate to the grandmothers and grandfathers and those ancestors that shaped me in terms of who I am. I just don't. And the reason is because young people have been so penetrated with a capitalist culture and the cultural superficial spectacle and instant gratification and overnight success and push button getting over. So in that sense, there's a shift from the John Coltranes and the Sarah Vaughns and the Curtis Mayfields and the Ray Charles and the Aretha Franklins into the bubblegum music that's too dominant. There's a shift. Now, we got a number of prophetic folk, but that is a shift. So when we talk about the young people who are to help make this fundamental social change, if you're not talking about courage, integrity, willingness to serve and sacrifice, then you're going to get bought out. You're going to sell out quick. You're not going to be a long-distance runner. You're going to be so obsessed with instant success and superficial status that you're going to make your grandmama weak from the grave. Because she wanted you to have earned greatness, not quick success. She wanted to measure it by the love in your heart and the service that you rendered, not what your position is and how big your crib is. That's a very different sensibility. And that's the tradition we got to keep. We got to fight for that. We got to keep it alive. And of course, it's at work in what Brother Rogers talked
about. Dr. West.
No, just quickly. Make poverty a priority in the national house and make it a priority in the world house. So that Latin America, Asia, Africa, every corner of the globe, poor people's humanity is accented and their capacities, abilities are accented in such a way that you can see their self-development and their self-realization. Their voices are heard at the highest level. But it means what? Righteous indignation, anger channeled through love and justice, not bigotry and revenge, but they'll never be changed given oligarchic rule if you don't get mad with love and courage and be willing to live and die for something bigger than you.
We are here to give prophetic information, scholarship, intellectuality, philosophic foundational material off of which to organize, and we think that one of the consummate, if not the consummate, person to do that is Brother Dr. Cornell West, who talks both truth to power, but most strategically, he is organizing. He is back home at Union Theological Seminary in Manhattan. He is back in the community on his second national poverty tour. Well, I will tell you that I have been inspired, encouraged. I have grown, I have learned, I have received my education, and I am truly, I'm not making him into an icon, but we have an awfully bright, active man who is with us now in New York, who has been on the front lines of activism, who is crisscrossing the country to deal with the issues of poverty, and I respect that, and we want to still encourage you. We want to encourage you to pay close attention, to listen. Dr. Cornell West, he is organizing on his second national poverty tour.
With the recession, the high unemployment, chronic unemployment, and the fact that new jobs are so hard to find, and when you find jobs, they're at almost poverty levels, poverty is increasing. And make no mistake about it, we're going to be experiencing high unemployment for a long time and low wages for a longer time, because it's like a reset button has been pushed. And the economy, when it comes back, will be coming back at a much lower level for the rest of us, while the rich are doing quite well, thank you. And that's the reason why Cornel West has entitled his book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto, because the rich are on our back in terms of the policies that they are pursuing with regard to Medicaid, with regard to minimum wage, and so many other issues for the closure crisis. And we need to get out there, not only for the other person who may be poor, but for ourselves and our children and everybody, our neighbors, because the calamity is a few percentage points each year. Over 5 years, it would be 10%, 15%. The economy is growing poorer for us and richer for the rich. And we need to do something about it. And Cornel West, in The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto, is a resource for you, is rich in statistics and conversation, in firsthand accounts. And Cornel West understands that the major issue today is poverty. Everybody's screaming about the destruction of the middle class, or I call middle income, and that's important. But what happens when you destroy the middle income is they become poor. We become poor. There are many important issues, but this is certainly one that people aren't talking about, poverty. And Dr. West has a unique capacity to communicate this.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.